If we can begin our first postprandial session, I'm Joe Morris. I'm the Chief of Staff of the United States Information Agency. The time is 2:14 and 45 seconds. And there, you have some United States information. That said, none of the remainder of my remarks is to be construed as an authoritative foreign policy pronouncement on behalf of the United States. But then, what is? Our topic this afternoon in this session is called United Nations, Canada, and the Commonwealth. Here we consider the relationships between the two democracies whose domestic and political and economic affairs we have been discussing up to this point, with the community of nations, and in particular with two very important, at least two very visible, multilateral organizations, two very visible multilateral communities of nations. It was my dubious distinction earlier this year to have served as a member of the United States delegation to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, which sits for 2 months out of every year in Geneva, 44 member states sending full delegations and roughly another 40 states sending observer delegation, including, I should note, observer delegations from those well-known independent foreign ministries of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic and the Belarusian Soviet Socialist Republic. There in Geneva, the delegates spend the dark winter and early spring months spending their taxpayers' money on splendid Swiss chocolates and some of the best restaurants in Europe, and accomplishing very little in the cause of human rights. I think that it is safe to say that the work of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, which was formed in the early afterglow of the victory of World War II, and the pronouncement by the United Nations of Eleanor Roosevelt's great diplomatic triumph, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, has in fact done little either on a theoretical or an actual plane to advance the cause of human rights just about anywhere. Those of you who take the notion of human rights seriously, particularly those of us in the conservative movement who take something of a Hofeldian approach toward the idea of rights, the notion that every right has a corresponding duty somewhere, so that, for example, there's no such thing as a free lunch, because if you have a right to a free lunch, someone somewhere has a duty to give you that free lunch. Therefore, there's a duty associated with the lunch. It's not truly free. And that's an important insight that the conservative movement has offered to the world, and which the world usually ignores. The Universal Declaration on Human Rights and other pronouncements of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights have done much to blur and obscure the meaning of rights. It's done much to debase the currency of the language of human rights. And so we have in documents as venerable as the Declaration of Human Rights 1946, as young as the Canadian Charter of Rights in this decade, we have being announced to the world as fundamental human rights, such ideas as the right to employment, not to be confused with Reed Larson's right to work, which is a very different breed of right, but the right to employment, the right to an education, the right to health, the right to family upbringing, the right to moral guidance, all of these, the right to a vacation, for working people is enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Canadian Charter of Fundamental Freedoms confers rights for a novel step in human history. It confers rights on two inanimate abstractions, the French and English languages, which under the Canadian Charter, the French and English languages under the Canadian Charter of Rights have equal rights in use in Canada. Not the people who speak those languages, but the languages themselves, in the words of the Canadian Charter, have rights. We have this language of rights now encrusted on a variety of legal instrumentalities, fomented primarily through the work of this organ of the United Nations, and now being reflected in what international lawyers call municipal law, meaning the law of individual nation states. Canada's Charter of Rights is a piece of municipal legislation in the eyes of Geneva. Enshrined as fundamental human rights right up there with quaint notions like freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right not to be incarcerated without some understanding of the charges and some opportunity to be heard and refute them, the right to be free from torture, the right not to be murdered by your own state. We have an equation in language that has evolved in the last two generations that debases the currency of human rights. Well, we've paid dearly for this as Americans and as Canadians. We have paid dearly in political terms, and we have paid dearly in straightforward economic terms. The principal governing body of the United Nations is its General Assembly. The General Assembly for this year convened this week. On Monday, President Reagan will travel to New York to address the plenary session of the General Assembly on behalf of the United States. The United States and Canada have approached the United Nations since its founding with extraordinary seriousness, a seriousness that, in all candor, just no longer, if it ever, befits the stature and the dignity of a political body which is controlled by a majority of states consisting primarily of two camps. One camp that constitutes the parliamentary majority of the United Nations is the Soviet bloc, a camp that benefits directly by the debasement of the currency of the language of human rights, because it is, of course, that language of human rights that gives the fundamental lie to what the Soviet system is about, and the extent to which a right to employment, and there's full employment in the Soviet Union, you know, and a right to a vacation, and Soviet workers do have vacations, and they have chess palaces and all sorts of other wonderful benefits of employment, the extent to which that can be equated with ideas of press freedom, religious freedom, speech freedom, political freedom, and the like, benefits the Soviet system directly. And of course, the Soviet's partners, the partner bloc in the United Nations political establishment, is that group of nations which recently celebrated 20 years of independence by eating their respective prime ministers. That is to say, as Pat Moynihan said a decade ago, the United States and the Western democracies are in the constellation of political organizations that is the United Nations, in opposition. We are in opposition. And yet, at least until very recently, the United States and other Western democracies have refused to recognize that they were in opposition, refused to understand that they occupied a political minority position in the organs of the United Nations, and refused to behave in a political way in the United Nations. As Jean Kirkpatrick observed when she led the intellectual turnaround in the approach, at least of America, to the United Nations, the fundamental rule of politics is the rule taught by Mayor Daley. You punish your enemies and you reward your friends. And for a long time, and even in no small measure today, the United States and the Western democracies have behaved in the United Nations in exactly the opposite way. We punish our friends, we reward our enemies. At a minimum, again and again and again, we have overlooked what our enemies have done to us in the United Nations. And we have joined in coalitions, we have joined in Pollyanna-ish movements in the United Nations, overlooking what our enemies have done to us outside the fora of the United Nations. But to a certain extent, at least in recent years, this has changed. It has changed in no small measure because of the views of Ronald Reagan, the views well articulated by Jean Kirkpatrick, by Alan Keyes, the incumbent Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations. One of the biggest challenges facing the United Nations this year is solving its own financial crisis. And that financial crisis in which the United Nations finds itself, largely, I mean, entirely of its own making, entirely of the making of its majority, was precipitated by At last, a cold and hard decision by the United States to call the United Nations organization to account for the way in which it spends its money. The United Nations spends about $5 billion a year on activities ranging from healthcare and refugee assistance to maintaining international peacekeeping forces of dubious effect. But the United Nations spends a full one-fifth of its budget on overhead, on administrative costs, including the salaries of 11,000 putatively international civil servants who work in the organization's headquarters in New York. I say putatively international civil servants because while the United States and Canada and other Western democracies take very seriously the proposition that employees of the Secretariat of the United Nations are truly international civil servants, not to be instructed by their governments of origin, I need not tell you that the majority bloc of the United Nations, in particular the Soviet bloc, do not play by those rules. Soviet employees of the United Nations Secretariat are understood to be Soviets first and to be instructed employees of the Soviet Union who turn over their salaries to the Soviet government and receive instead a stipend from the treasury of the USSR, which corresponds to the not to the pay of international civil servants, which is driven by and exceeds the highest pay rates of the American civil service, but instead Soviet international civil servants are paid the paltry sums in ruble accounts where possible that are paid to employees of the Soviet government. In the last decade, this part of the UN's budget has tripled, the overhead part of the budget has tripled, reaching $830 million. Now, at the demand of the United States and others, the organization has ordered a pay freeze for its employees, it's cut back travel funds, it's postponed a multi-million dollar conference center that was going to be built in Ethiopia, in starving Ethiopia. In all, these reductions, produced with great wailing and gnashing of teeth, achieved a savings of about $30 million. Unfortunately, those cuts will not begin to cover the shortfall in the UN's budget. The United States government certainly hopes that in this fall's General Assembly, member nations will take a hard look at spending priorities. In fact, a report by the Committee of 18 has just been issued with some 70 recommendations that the United States government has welcomed for reducing UN expenditures. But in all candor, the budget crisis that the United Nations faces calls for a certain self-discipline that just is not now encouraged by the rules that govern UN funding. More than 80 nations out of the UN's membership of roughly 150 pay the minimum UN contribution, less than $80,000 per country. Taken together, the contributions of 80 nations total only 1% of the UN's budget. A dozen countries, and you know which dozen they are, pay 80% of the UN's budget. The United States, the largest contributor, pays one-fourth of all the UN's budget. That was $940 million, almost $1 billion, in 1985. Yet the smallest 80 contributors, 1% of the budget, have the votes to pass the budget. And they pass 99% of the costs for the activities that they promote, their conferences on themes of their choosing, to the other members. The result is, of course, a runaway budget. Now, at the same time that the United States, primarily through, I must tell you again in candor, primarily not through exertions of the executive branch, but primarily through exertions of Congress, Senator Dole, Senator Kassebaum, and others, has forced a certain discipline on the United Nations by a threat to reduce the American contribution to the UN from 25% of its budget to 20% of its budget. But imposing financial discipline on the United Nations is just the beginning of the change, the political change that the Western democracies must undertake. Time and time again in the context of the United Nations, the Western democracies injure themselves. And let me give you one illustration of that from my own experience at the UN Commission on Human Rights before I call on one of the West's leading thinkers on the problem of the United Nations to bring into sharp focus for you how he has led the fight to correct both political and financial UN abuses in one particular area. At the UN Commission on Human Rights in Geneva earlier this year, we in the American delegation decided to focus the attention of the Commission on the horrific abuses of human rights being carried out in Ethiopia by the Marxist government of that country. Ethiopia is racked by drought and famine. It is, however, a drought and a famine that have been governmentally managed. The government under the government of Ethiopia has put up a false front of humanitarian enterprises to relieve the suffering of its people. It has accepted assistance in large quantities from Western governments, from multilateral organizations, and even from individuals in the West who have raised vast quantities of money for relief in Ethiopia under the well-known banners of Band-Aid and Live Aid and USA for Africa, shipping grain, shipping medical supplies, shipping trucks and buses to Ethiopia, more than half of which have either rotted on docks or been turned around by the Ethiopian government, sold on world markets for hard currencies, those hard currencies then in turn transferred to Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union and East Germany for arms. So that in the midst of this drought and famine in Ethiopia, Ethiopia has been able to marshal the largest standing army in sub-Saharan Africa. That standing army and the drought and the famine that the government of Ethiopia has managed,
how about you?
Are used to suppress political rebellions, anti-Marxist rebellions and ethnic minority rebellions in two major sectors of the country. And the Ethiopian government, in the guise of humanitarian relief, has imposed draconian population resettlement and relocation measures. I say in the guise of humanitarian relief efforts, in fact, to force population shifts to bring about political results. When the United States delegation put forward a draft resolution in the caucus of Western democracies that met every day before we went out onto the floor, that resolution criticizing the Ethiopian government's handling of public and private assistance received from the West was opposed by the head of the Canadian delegation, the Right Honorable Gordon Fairweather, chairman of the Canadian Commission on Human Rights, a red Tory. Mr. Fairweather, who is well named in view of his friendship for human rights, Mr. Fairweather took the floor in the Western Caucus to oppose any criticism of Ethiopia or of the abuse of these assistance programs because he argued if the word ever got back to our populations, meaning our employers, the people of Canada and the United States and Sweden and Norway and France and Britain and the other Western countries contributing assistance to Ethiopia, if the word ever got back that there was any question whatsoever about what countries did with their foreign aid allotments, why, that would just aid and abet the sentiments of those fascists back home who want to cut off foreign aid. Better we should keep quiet and allow the Ethiopians to convert foreign aid into means of repression and torture of their people than to call into question the underpinnings of foreign assistance programs. I am ashamed to tell you that Mr. Fairweather prevailed. And with the United States and Israel and Britain and a tiny handful of other countries standing alone, the UN Commission on Human Rights overwhelmingly voted down even the consideration, even the discussion of the status of human rights in Ethiopia. Bad as the United Nations Commission on Human Rights has been, it does not hold a candle for wickedness
illegal
to the United Nations educational, scientific, and cultural organization, the evil UNESCO. I am proud to be able to tell you today that the United States is no longer a member of UNESCO. Neither are the United Kingdom nor Singapore, as of at least the end of this year when their notices take effect. This transformation, this militancy on the part of the United States, and this growing militancy in the West to call the United Nations and its organs to account, is in no small measure the fruit of the work of a single man, a driven mind, Owen Herries. Owen Herries, an academic, a scholar from Australia who served in his country's Ministry of External Affairs as the head of policy planning, personal foreign policy advisor to Prime Minister Fraser, Australia's ambassador to UNESCO, late a consultant and senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, and now the founder and guiding genius behind a splendid new journal available for your perusal in the lobby, The National Interest. Owen Herries has made the case, opened the eyes of Western policymakers to the UNESCO problem and related problems, and it's my pleasure to call on Owen Herries now to state the case for you.